Hello and welcome back to ACRAC. I'm Jed Wolpaw, and I'm absolutely thrilled because I have back with me today two former superstar guests, Dr. Michael Asando and Dr. Joe Cody. They, you may remember, used to work together at The Ohio State University, where Dr. Asando is still a professor of anesthesiology and the assistant dean for graduate medical education. But Dr. Cody, as these things happen, graduated from fellowship, I'm sure with flying colors, and is now down in Florida in the warm weather, where he's a cardiac anesthesiologist in the community setting at quite a busy center doing hearts and a lot of other things. And I'm going to ask him to tell us a little bit about that in a second. I do just want to remind everyone that ACRAC now offers CME credit. So if you want or need CME, you can go to the website, click on the links for CME and get it that way. All right, let's jump in. We're going to talk about the mitral clip procedure, how that works, why it's being done. This is, if you don't know, and we'll learn a lot more about it, but is a new way of managing mitral valve disease. And I'm really excited to learn more about it and share that with all of you. So, Joe and Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having us, Jed.
Thanks for having us again. It's always an honor and a privilege to be an ACRAC.
Thanks so much. All right. So I want to start, though, Joe, by asking you, tell us a little bit about that transition, because I'm sure there are folks out there listening who are fellows now or residents going to be fellows thinking about that transition from fellowship to private practice. And just talk a little bit about, you know, what that was like for you, how you picked where you are and what you're doing, what your practice looks like now.
Yeah, sure. So I was trained by Mike at Ohio State. So my transition was pretty smooth because of the good training that I got there, and as a resident through Allegheny in Pittsburgh, and I wanted a job where I could do a fair bit of cardiac, but I felt like I spent so much time in training doing OB and regional and peds and all those stuff. So I wanted a job where I could use my fellowship, and so they brought me in as kind of a cardiac guy. So that's kind of where they stick me most days. So I usually do 1 to 3 pump cases for like either a valve or CABG surgery or similar per week. And then other days I'm placed in, I'm taking care of patients in the structural heart setting. So that would be either TAVRs, Watchman's, mitral clips, that kind of group of procedures. And then if they don't have that going on, I'm doing OB or peds or ortho, or so I get to do a little bit of everything, but mostly cardiac. And it's really great because it was kind of the perfect job for me. We have residents that rotate through. It's not really a residency, but I still kind of get to teach too. So for me, it's kind of been the perfect job. I don't think I'll ever be a full professor and dean of GME like Mike, but I get to do what is good for me, and it's a good fit for me. So, yeah.
That's great. Well, I'm thrilled, and I think, really good for people to realize that there are so many different paths to interesting careers and to happiness, right? So, really, thanks for sharing that. Let's jump in. Mike, maybe we'll start with you. If you could talk a little bit about, maybe just review with us, mitral regurgitation. You know, what is it? What does it mean? What kind of hemodynamic complications are associated with it? And that, of course, is going to take us into the mitral clip, which is a treatment for mitral regurgitation. But let's start with just a review of mitral regurgitation. What do you think it's important for people to know to understand our discussion to come?
Excellent. I think that's a great way to start. So I'll start off by saying that to really grasp a great understanding of mitral regurgitation, it's important to understand what the mitral valve is made of. So the mitral valve is different from the aortic valve. The aortic valve is essentially the leaflets, the annulus, and that's about it. The mitral valve, on the other hand, is a complex. So it's made up of the leaflets, the commissures, then you have chordae tendineae that attach the leaflets to the papillary muscle. So then after the papillary muscle, you have the underlying left ventricle. And so any dysfunction of any of these components, even including the left atrial wall. So if you have left atrial enlargement, it would lead to a dilation of the annulus that will lead to mitral regurgitation. If you have somebody who has an acute myocardial infarction and they develop a papillary muscle rupture, that will lead to mitral regurgitation. So if you have a patient who develops global left ventricular dysfunction, or even If you have a dyssynchrony of the left ventricle from right ventricular pacing, that would also lead to mitral regurgitation. So mitral regurgitation essentially is a heterogeneous, you know, disease, and the etiologies can be due to any dysfunction of any of these, you know, components. And essentially, if you go by the strict, you know, classification for you know, classifying the classification of mitral regurgitation, there are two types. You have the primary mitral regurgitation, which is a disease of the leaflets themselves. Other sources may call it organic. So it's a mitral leaflet disease. Whereas the secondary mitral regurgitation is the case where the leaflets are actually functionally normal, but disease of other components, such as most commonly, if you have a left ventricular dilatation from any cardiomyopathy, or you have, you know, annular dilation from any functional, any dysfunction of the left ventricle, that will lead to, you know, secondary MR. So it's really critical to basically understand that mitral regurgitation is a heterogeneous disease. It can be a primary, it can be secondary, or you can have components of both primary or secondary in any patient where, let's say, a patient may have a prolapse of the anterior mitral valve leaflet, which is a primary etiology, but they also have a baseline underlying cardiomyopathy. So the left ventricle is dilated. So then you have tetering where the leaflets are kind of pulled down into the left ventricle, like apically. So those are the two main, you know, components or types of mitral regurgitation. Hemodynamically, normally and systole, when the left ventricle contracts, the mitral valve leaflets meet at the coaptation zone, which is along the line of the commissure, and then close. And by so doing, the left ventricle is pressurized and the blood goes out through the aortic valves and into the systemic circulation. But when you have mitral valve dysfunction which is causing regurgitation, when the ventricle undergoes systole, the blood flow regurgitates into the left atrium. So you develop left atrial hypertension, the left atrial wall tension increases. And this vicious cycle leads to a further increase in the preload of the left ventricle. So whenever there's another systolic event, you have an increase in left atrial pressures, which leads to back filling of the pulmonary veins. So the patient develops heart failure symptoms where especially once they start exercising and the left atrial pressure increases and the pulmonary venous capacitance increases from all that blood going backwards, they just have poor functional status. So hemodynamically, those are the main considerations. And then other issues that can happen from that is the right ventricle, from the chronic volume overloading of the left atrium and the pulmonary circulation, may also become dysfunctional. And then with the increased wall tension in the left atrium, patients also become prone to atrial arrhythmias. So over time, it's really essential that if a patient has chronic mitral regurgitation, to follow them with serial echocardiograms and also listen to them and get a sense of what their functional status is. Because once the MR goes to from moderate to severe, like when you get into that range, which is also called greater than 3+ MR, if the patient has symptoms or the left ventricle is dilated, that is a time to really get the patient for some therapy, whether it's surgical repair of the mitral valve or replacement, or as we would discuss, you know, on this forum, mitral clip implantation to try and reverse the vicious cycle of volume overload, which leads to further LV volume overload, arrhythmias, poor functional capacity, etc.
Great. Thanks, Mike. Now, just out of curiosity, with secondary MR, do you get recovery sometimes if you fix the underlying problem? So let's say it's from, you know, left ventricular dilation, but you kind of fix the pressure issue, or you can get a little bit of repair there, or, you know, these might not be great examples, but you know what I mean? If you can fix what's causing the secondary MR, will that sometimes revert back to better, or once you get to a certain point, are you kind of set with having to repair the valve?
Yes, that's an excellent question. So once again, when you talk secondary, it's not a valvular leaflet disease. So when you do an assessment, you always want to find out what is the cause of it. So if it's a patient that has like let's say, a right coronary issue where the inferior wall is dyskinetic and they have mitral regurgitation as a result of that, when you do either a coronary stent or you do a coronary artery bypass grafting and you improve coronary blood flow, as long as you still have great myocardial viability in that region, if your myocardium starts contracting in synchrony, majority of the time the MR would go away. The issue becomes patients where you don't detect the MR early and then they develop such, you know, apical and lateral displacement of the left ventricle that even when you do a bypass, you may not be able to recover that LV function. But one other thing to consider is it used to be that surgically, we used to think that if you just reduce the annulus of the mitral valve and bring the leaflets together, that the secondary mitral regurgitation would go away. And there's multiple surgical, you know, publications that have indicated that that is not the case, because you bring the leaflets together by reducing the annulus, but if the left ventricle, the left ventricular disease keeps progressing, it would keep pulling those leaflets apically. So within like a year or two, secondary MR that is fixed by an annuloplasty recurs a lot. So that's why there is now an indication of doing the mitral clip for secondary MR, because it brings the leaflets together and takes away the ventricular aspect of pulling the leaflets, you know, apart.
Great. Okay. Now, are you going to assess patients? You mentioned following them with echo as if they have MR to kind of follow it over time and assess whether it's getting worse, plus their symptoms, of course. What are you seeing on echo that's going to make you think it's now time for a repair? And then is there a way, based on what you see, that you can decide, should this patient get an open repair versus the mitral clip, which is going to be an endovascular repair?
Fantastic. So the first thing is, till now, surgery is still the primary therapy for mitral regurgitation and for organic or primary mitral regurgitation. Secondary MR is still debatable. You should just leave it as a bypass or whether you should replace the valve, because it's been demonstrated that repair with a restrictive annuloplasty does not take away secondary mitral regurgitation. So when a patient develops MR, the first thing you do echocardiographically is you want to determine the etiology, right? And that involves doing an anatomical assessment. And use either the Carpentier classification or other approaches. So you want to see, is this a primary MR or is it a secondary MR? So that's the first, you know, structured approach to it. And once you determine the mechanism of the MR, then you go a step further to determine the severity and then the patient's symptoms. So anatomically, for primary MR, you're looking for a flail or a prolapse. And then after that, you look at the left ventricle, look at the left ventricular size, look at the size of the left atrium, because if you have chronic MR, both chambers will be enlarged. So that also gives you an inclination of the chronicity and the severity, you know, of the left ventricle. And then especially for secondary MR, there are other quantifications, such as looking at the leaflets are pulled apically. So it's called, you know, tension. So you can look at like the tension height, the tension areas, and that tells you that this patient has had a chronic secondary MR from, you know, chronic dilation of the left ventricle. So after you determine the mechanism, then you to determine the severity. So when you talk about severity of MR, there are a lot of, you know, and you want to do it, which other trials like the COAPT trial and the Everest trial have, you know, suggested, you want to use physicians that have been trained and have experience in quantifying mitral regurgitation. So most quantitative things that we use are such as the left atrium, the area of the mitral regurgitation in relation to the area of the left atrium. Another, you know, parameter is what we call the vena contractor. We have a vena contractor width, which is the narrowest point of the mitral regurgitation. And we also have a vena contractor area, which is the narrowest area of the mitral regurgitation. And then you can progress to the regurgitant volume. How much of the stroke volume going through the mitral valve regurgitates back into the left atrium? If it's 60%, that volume is too high, 60 milliliters, that volume is too high and it's such a high regurgitant volume. And you also want to look at the regurgitant fraction. What fraction of the stroke volume that goes through the mitral valve regurgitates back? If it's 50%, that's a high regurgitant fraction. That's, you know, reflective of severe mitral regurgitation. And then one other thing you can do is you can measure the regurgitant orifice area, which is like the dimension of the mitral regurgitation, the orifice. And if that regurgitant orifice area is close to 0.4 centimeters squared, that's also a reflection of severe MR. And then other, like, they are quantitative, but a little more on the qualitative side. We look at the pulmonary veins, because if when blood goes backwards, it causes flow reversal. So if the flow in the pulmonary vein reverses backwards, like reverses in systole, you have severe mitral regurgitation. And also if you do a continuous wave assessment where you basically analyze through the mitral in diastole and you compare the density of that envelope to the envelope when there is mitral regurgitation. If there's a lot of red blood cells regurgitating backwards into the left atrium, that's also, you know, a reflection of severe mitral regurgitation. So when it comes to identifying MR, you look at the mechanism, then you go to the quantification. And if the patient is symptomatic and has greater than 3+, which is moderate to severe mitral regurgitation, you don't want to wait further, because then the left ventricle may become so dysfunctional that when you fix the mitral regurgitation, it's not going to recover. So at that point, you basically have to determine, is this patient sick enough based on their Society of Thoracic Surgical score or Euroscore 2? How sick are they to tolerate cardiopulmonary bypass for big mitral valve surgery? Or are they too sick that a quicker approach with a mitral clip may basically reduce the regurgitation, improve their functional capacity, reduce their hospitalizations for heart failure, and basically improve their quality of life? So that's where we are. And this decision is made by a multidisciplinary heart team, including anesthesiologists, cardiac surgeons, heart failure physicians, and others. And also, we also have to understand that if there is dyskinesis in a lot of patients, from somebody that's being paced, if you do a coronary sinus lead and do biventricular pacing, the MR may also go away. So mechanism is important, then scaling of the severity, and then you decide where the patient fits for therapies.
Great. All right. So that was a great overview of what we're looking at in the echo. And then what we really want to know in terms of patient selection, as you said, is this somebody who needs a repair but isn't going to tolerate a big open, you know, bypass surgery? And in that case, they might be a good candidate for this endovascular surgery. So kind of similar to a TAVR in the sense of, can you tolerate a big open heart surgery, or is it better to do something endovascularly? All right, Joe, why don't we turn to you and talk a little bit about why? I mean, we just said some people can't tolerate a big open surgery, so that's part of it. But what is or maybe that's it, but are there other reasons why we think that this was important? Why was MitraClip invented? What was the purpose? And, you know, how exactly are we thinking about it in terms of who would qualify? And are there contraindications where patients just wouldn't be a good for this procedure?
Yeah, so the concept of the MitraClip and other thing that people will talk about is edge to edge repair, or abbreviation for it is TEER, transcatheter edge to edge repair. And it was actually born from a surgical technique that started in the early 90s. There's an Italian cardiac surgeon. He's still practicing, Dr. Alfieri, who came up with this idea where he put a stitch in between the anterior and posterior leaflet of the mitral valve. So going back to anatomy, the mitral valve has two leaflets, and he basically stitched them together. So instead of it having a single orifice, it had two. So it's not like he sewed the valve shut. He just put a single stitch in the middle. And the idea was it would promote more forward flow and less regurgitant flow, which actually panned out to be true. And so then the early 2000s came, and the transcatheter technology started to take off. And they said, well, maybe we'll copy what he did in surgery through a transcatheter approach. So that's sort of how that was born. So that's sort of the first part of your question, I think. And then who's a candidate, who's not? So I think if going back, and I'm going to say what that was, some of the same things that Mike just said, but I think it's important because it covers kind of the big picture thing. So if it's a patient where the disease is just the mitral valve, and it's not the LV, it's not the LA, you know, say it's a young, healthy person with a P2 prolapse or something where their heart's fine. It's just the valve. Currently, and it's better for those patients to go to the OR and get that fixed. If it's someone who's old and frail, who may not tolerate surgery, or it could be somebody where the mechanism is different. So in like ischemic MR, those patients are better to go for the mitral clip.
Okay, and are there comorbidities or situations in which you can't do it? I mean, for example, if a patient has concomitant mitral stenosis and mitral regurgitation, maybe you tell me, but maybe they're not the best candidate.
Yeah. So a complication of the procedure is actually mitral stenosis. So the guideline says that if the mitral valve area starting out is 4 centimeters squared or smaller, they're probably not a great a candidate. Other things, because it is an endovascular procedure, if they have problems in their femoral veins, if they have a thrombus in the femoral vein or the IVC, if there's a thrombus in the atria, if there's a problem with the septum, if they have an ASC that's been fixed, that's something to think about. That could get things could be tricky. If the patient has perforation from endocarditis, so those are some patients who really you probably shouldn't do it in.
Okay, that makes sense. Now, when patients get this done, I assume the clip is made of some sort of material that is not tissue, and so do they need to be anticoagulated?
They are if you look at the COAPS trial and the Everest trial, for a certain period of time post clipping, patients were put on dual antiplatelet therapy. So for a certain period of time, and the exception is if the patient has AFib, then they're usually on Eliquis or something else for anticoagulation, and those patients, that they would not have that. So yeah.
Okay, so they need some anticoagulation at least for a while afterwards. Mm-hmm, so if someone can't tolerate that, you know, they can't get this.
Right.
Now that said, if you're going to get an open surgical approach, you're going to need bypass and you're going to have full heparinization at least for the procedure. So nobody, for example, somebody with a head bleed can't get either one of these, right?
Yeah, right. No.
But I guess you may, if you got a new mitral valve in an open procedure and they put in a porcine valve, you wouldn't need long-term anticoagulation.
No,
but you would.
It's not, but well, right. But for a short term, I forget the guidelines now. I think it's 3 months, Mike. That could be wrong, but.
So when you, even the mitral clip, they recommend, lifelong aspirin, like if the patient can tolerate it, but they do antiplatelet therapy, as Joe said, that's for 30 days. Okay. So until the body kind of endothelializes over the clip, you know, then you have to be on, you know, dual antiplatelet therapy to reduce thrombosis. Yeah.
And what if you get open surgery? What's the shortest amount of time you'd need anticoagulation after an open surgery?
So it's also dependent, but especially if it's repair, then it's also short term. You know, not necessary. I don't even think dual antiplatelets necessary. Aspirin definitely, but obviously if it's a repair with a mechanical valve, then that's lifelong anticoagulation.
Right. Okay. So some pros and cons there, depending on what kind of you need and what your other comorbidities are. All right. So let's turn to you, Mike, and tell me a little bit about the current systems that are being used now. I'm sure this is not brand new. This has been being used for a little bit of time now. You'll be able to tell us how long, but I'm sure we've gone through multiple generations. So tell us what the newest generation is and how that differs from the kind of original approaches at this. And just, you know, again, I remember the first time I heard about this thinking, this can't be right. You're telling me that you're going in there and clipping the mitral valve together, right? That seems like, I mean, I think on first blush, it sounds like, oh, well, you're taking mitral regurgitation and just converting it into mitral stenosis. But there must, obviously this works or we wouldn't be doing it. So, you know, what is it about the methods that they're using that actually produces a good result? And is the newest generation able to do that in a better way? How have they optimized this thing over time?
Okay, perfect. So I'll give you a little historical perspective. So as Joe stated earlier, the first trial that led to FDA approval of the mitral clip was the EVEREST II trial. And in that trial, it was mainly the use of mitral clip in patients with organic mitral regurgitation. So primary organic, where they have most of them have either a prolapse or a flail. And you use echocardiography to look at where that site is. And then you go and clip the anterior leaflet to the posterior leaflet at the site of the regurgitation. And the majority of the time was where, you know, most of these organic MRs are in the P2, A2 region. So you go in, you know, which we'll describe the procedure in a bit here, and then you clip the A2 to P2 region. So you create a dual orifice mitral valve. And that was the EVEREST trial. And then, so those were patients who were not as sick, but we're all primary MR. Then fast forward to the COAPT trial, which led to FDA approval for secondary MR in 2019, where they used the mitral clip again, but for a different population of patients. Obviously, these are patients with dilated left ventricle. The ejection fractions range from 20 to 50%. And then you essentially also went and clipped the anterior to posterior leaflet. And as Joe stated earlier, the goal is you want to rule out patients who have a small mitral valve going in into the procedure so you don't make them you don't worsen the stenosis. Even though there are patients that develop gradients, which are, you know, higher than normal, like greater than 5 millimeters of mercury, it was still seen a lot of the results from these two pivotal trials that a slight elevation in the mitral gradient was still better in these super sick patients that really had no options, to the point that their functional capacity was better, they had less symptoms. And critically, especially in the COAPT trial, there was a really profound survival benefit with the mitral clip in comparison to maximally tolerated guideline-directed medical therapy. And then the frequency of hospitalizations for mitral regurgitation was really dramatically lower. So the trials have proven that the mitral clip works, but the first generation was only a one-size-fits-all. So those of us that are old enough and were involved in the EVEREST II trial, it took forever. Sometimes it was 3-4 hours just to put a clip in. And it was because it was just one size, one length, one width. So you could not customize it to any patient. It's whatever you have. If you can grasp the leaflets, you could. If you couldn't, sometimes you aborted. So now we're in the fourth generation of the mitral clip. And that's the mitral clip G4 system. So that comes with a few changes in the specification. So now there are four clips. There is the NT, NTW, XT, and XTW. So the NT and the XT are like the older, the third generation version, and the NTW and the, you know, XTW are like the fourth generation. And the differences are just the length of the clip and the width. So the NT is the shorter clip. It has a 9 millimeter arm length. So if you have a patient specifically who has shorter leaflets, which is most of the secondary MR patients, they don't have redundant, like Barlow's, thick and long leaflets. So if you put a longer clip, you're going to encroach on the commissures and you can potentially cause microstenosis, or you can even perforate a leaflet at the level of the commissure. So a shorter leaflet, like the secondary MR patient, you're going to put an NT in. So the NT is all the NTs, NT and NTW are 9 millimeters in leaflet length. But then we also realize that when you put an NT in, it's a thin clip. And you may clip the anterior and posterior leaflet, but then there is such a wide separation that you still have a lot of residual MR going around the leaflet. So that led to the development of the W, which is the NT wide. So if you have a secondary MR patient who has a broader based MR, with the older generation, you may put 2 or 3 clips in. But currently with the NTW, you may put 1 clip W, the wider, which is a 6 millimeter width compared to the NT, which is a 4 millimeter width. So you can grasp more of the leaflet, better acute procedural success of reducing the MR, and which you want it to be less than 2+. So then we get to the XT and the XTW. That is more for patients with Barlow's or myxomatose longer leaflets. Once again, the XT is a 12 millimeter arm, you know, length, whereas the XTW is 12 millimeter arm length, but it has a wider, the width is 6 millimeters, whilst the XT is 6. So in contemporary practice, the most implanted of the 4 are the NTW and the XTW. And another really cool way to, you know, treat these patients is you can also combine these clips. So you may put an NTW here and an XTW at another section of the same valve, and you get really nice outcomes. And the last improvement of the newer G4 system is, a lot of times when we finish, we used to put PA catheters in and we follow, you know, wedge pressures or PA diastolics to see if we really treated the MR appropriately, which would lead to a reduction, you know, in the pulmonary capillary wedge pressure. But with the newer MitraClip G4 system, the clip delivery, the steerable guide catheter, you can continuously monitor left atrial pressure. So if you put a clip in and before you place the, so let's say before you place a clip, the patient has the left atrial pressure of maybe 18. Then you put a clip in and it drops down to 12. You know for sure that you've reduced the recurrent artifice error. But if you reduce it, and let's say you're not happy with it, and you attempt to place another clip, and all of a sudden you have a rise in your left atrial pressure, that's a reflection that you're transforming a mitral regurgitate lesion to a mitral stenotic lesion. And then you just make that decision that it's not advisable for us to put that clip. We used to rely on echocardiography to get all these numbers, which there's a question of accuracy with really having true left atrial pressures. There's nothing better than having a catheter which is sitting in the left atrium so you can continuously monitor your pressures. So those are the two main transformations with the G4 system. It's really a cool system.
Great, thank you. A couple questions. So when there must be a way, they've got this clip in there, and like you said, let's say they put one in, looks good, left atrial pressure went down, you put that second one in, oh, it went up. This was not a good move here. So you can then just take it right out, right? There must be a way to kind of put it in, see what will happen, and then say nope and take it out.
Stay with us. We'll be right back with Mike's answer to that question.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
All right, we're back, and Mike's going to tell us if you can just take that thing out if you need to.
Perfect, yeah. Another improvement, which I should have stated, of the G4 system is the fact that you can either grasp one leaflet at a time, or you can grasp both leaflets simultaneously. The older system was to clip both leaflets at the same time, which was very, very difficult. So what we the workflow is, you can grasp the leaflet and then assess with echocardiography and left atrial pressures to see if you have optimally corrected the MR or you're inducing mitral stenosis. So that is not releasing of the clip. So you've sort of grasped it, you do all your hemodynamic and echocardiographic assessment, and once you're really satisfied with the location of the clip, you also want to ensure that you really did grasp them firmly, because there are reports of the clip basically attaching to just one leaflet, which can risk embolization down the line. So you do all these assessments, and once you're happy, then you release it. So it's called, you can do, it's called independent or simultaneous, you know, leaflet grasping actuation. And it's really cool. You can see it open and close on echo. And once you're really satisfied with the location and the hemodynamics and the MR correction, then you release it. That once you release it, it's over.
Right, right. Okay, well, that's great. And then I think we should, let's just revisit the terminology for a second, because we've been using the terms A2 and P2, and, you know, some people may not be familiar with that. So I think there are there's the anterior and the posterior leaflet of the mitral valve. That's A for anterior, P for posterior. And then are they each divided into three kind of sections? Is that right?
Yeah, yes. Perfect. Okay. Joe can take it or I can take it.
No, I mean, there's really not much to add there. I mean, there's basically, there's the, anterior and posterior, leaflet, and they're divided into three scallops, and so from a echo standpoint, it's pretty easy to identify that the, three different scallops on each leaflet. And then from a procedural standpoint, the cardiologist will kind of decide, okay, I should clip the A2P2, and so that's sort of how that works.
Okay, and that's the middle section of each leaflet, right?
Correct. Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay. Right. And so, is that, Mike? You said that's the most common. A2P2 is the most common, which makes sense. It's right in the middle. It sounds like sometimes you may need to do more than one. So depending on what the dynamics of the valve are, how bad it is, you might clip A2 to P2 and A1 to A2 or something, or to P2 or something like that, right? I imagine you're never going to clip, but you tell me, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm just guessing you're not going to clip like A1 to P3.
Yes, you never clip across. So the good thing is, as Joe was stating, it's more like, it's like, you know, it's like a curved, you know, it's like a saddle shape. And then, so the A1, you know, we call it coaptation, like where the anterior meets the posterior. So A1 meets P1, A2 meets P2, A3 meets P3. And the clip is implanted perpendicular to the corresponding anterior and posterior segment. So you can, it's not even possible to go across and staple A. If you staple A, let's say A1 to P3, you basically stapling the valve shut. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I guess you can do it, but it would not.
never gonna want to do it. Okay.
Never gonna do it. Yeah.
Good. All right. Well, let's talk about the actual procedure itself. So, Joe, do you want to take us through what is the procedure for putting this thing in? How do they do it?
Yeah, sure. So, step by step, it's typically done in a cath lab or hybrid OR, because it needs fluoro. And TE for guidance, and it's done with general anesthesia, because the TE probe has to stay there for some time, and B, it's helpful if the patient is extremely still for them to place these clips in a very, very specific spot. So patient comes back, they go to sleep, TE probe is placed, and then from there the cardiologist needs to do something called a transseptal approach. So it's a common approach. It's used in structural heart. It's used in ablations for most forms of AFib. What that means is the EP cardiologist will access the femoral vein, will actually stay on the venous side at the beginning of the procedure. they'll go up the venous side into the right atrium to the atrial septum area. And then they have to cross that septum to get to the left atrium to access the mitral valve. So it's a common procedure up until that point for multiple indications that I had mentioned. But it's critical that they cross the septum at just the right point, because if they cross too high, too low, too anterior, too posterior, it's difficult for them to maneuver the catheter to place the mitral clip in the right spot. So
Joe, they're creating an ASD, right? I mean, that's what they're doing. They're creating an atrial septal defect.
Correct. which they often will spontaneously close with time. But sometimes they don't, and sometimes they do have to intervene on them, but they usually don't. When the procedure's done, the ASD just stays there. As long as it doesn't cause problems, they just leave it. So basically, and it's important to say that anytime the cardiologist crosses from the right to the left side, patients should be heparinized too, because otherwise you could have a thrombus form that could go to the brain, the coronaries, someplace bad, basically. So then after the cardiologist has made it LA, he or she takes a special kind of catheter, and with the assistance of TE guidance and fluoroscopy guidance, can actually guide the catheter to the location of the mitral valve and apply these clips.
Okay, so that's how they do it, and it sounds like a really key component of this is that transseptal approach, because until then it's really quite standard and you don't need anticoagulation, and it's you're just getting into the right heart. But when you cross over into the left heart, it kind of takes a step up in complexity. As you said, you have to find exactly the right spot. If you don't go over in the right area, you're going to have difficulty maneuvering, and then of course you have to know there's potential complications associated with that. All right, but you get over there, you then of course are on the left side, which is where the mitral valve is, and you access the part of it. And give me an idea of like, if all goes well, how long does this take? Like, what's a reasonable average, assuming, there's no major complications, just kind of average procedure if it goes well?
I mean, it's that's a tough question. I think it depends on the experience of the operator, the number of clips needed, the complexity of the disease itself, of the mitral valve. But if things go well at my center, after they cross the septum, which probably takes about 20 from prepping and everything, probably 20 to 30 minutes. To place a clip is probably another 15 to 30 minutes once the septum's crossed at my center. I don't know, Mike, is it probably similar?
Well, should we assume that, since a C-section in private practice takes about a half an hour and in academics takes about 6 hours, that it's the same or no?
No, I think it's the procedure, Joe is correct. The procedure has transformed. So just to share some anecdotes. So during the Everest and Coab trials, right? So most transseptal procedures were being done in the EP world, where those, the EP physicians would do transseptal. And even for the cardiac anesthesiologist, we had to kind of learn how to guide them with the best site for transseptal puncture. So just the transseptal puncture alone was taking a little bit of time. But in this day and age, after, you know, the co-op trial and Everest trials, it takes maybe an hour and a half. So you're basically taking a critically ill patient, and then the monitoring, the scale of the monitoring is reduced. So they get, you know, with ultrasound guidance, they get into the femoral vein in a few, you know, like a minute, whatever it is. They get into the right atrium. We guide them transeptally, heparinized to an ACT of like 250s. And then they all, once you just do that, they are ready to grasp the leaflets. And it used to be difficult, you know, as Joe shared before, because you have to grasp both leaflets at the same time. So if one leaflet is going this way, the other is going the other way, it was just hard to basically grasp them three-dimensionally and clip them. And we were using mostly two-dimensional echoes. So things are better now because you can grasp independently, you know, the leaflets independently. And then you have fluoroscopy, and we have three-dimensional echo and four-dimensional echo, and, you know, based on where you're working at. So you can really see things with precision, and they would go and target that location, grasp the leaflets in no time. Sometimes you grasp one, and then you pull it a little bit to graft the other. You didn't have that option before. So timing of the procedure is really, really not too bad. Like an hour and a half tops, even in academics.
Great. Yeah, no, great. And things have changed too, because the G4 system came out in 2019 or so. And I'm starting to see patients that had a MitraClip place prior to the G4 system, where they might have had some trouble and a single clip got placed on, but their MR was still not really that good, and they're still having symptoms. And then they'll actually come back for a second clip that they'll try with the improved system. So things have really, the technology just keeps getting better and better. I didn't have to struggle through the Everest trial that period. I think I was still in high school when Mike was doing that.
All right. Now, the patient is under what kind of anesthesia during this?
It's general anesthesia. So it's typically goals for that. I usually place in arterial line prior to going to sleep, just because these patients do tend to be sicker, and there's really no huge downside to doing that. And then just a slow induction, the placement of an endotracheal tube, TE probe, and then when the case is over, it's actually critical to ensure with TE that there's not a pericardial effusion. That's a known complication that can occur most commonly when they're doing the transseptal puncture, but it could occur at some other point too. And then after that, at my center, they'll either go to step down or to ICU, but that may mean just from a logistics standpoint that they make a pit stop in the PACU. So it's important taking care of these patients in the recovery room. If they get a hypotensive or something, you start to think about things that could be going on. And I have a pretty low threshold to call for a bedside TTE to ensure that that a pericardial effusion didn't develop, because I've seen it where we check in the room with TE, there's no effusion, things look good, you get them to PACU, blood pressure's kind of soft, they're often beta block, so everything looks good, the heart rate's kind of low, you're like, okay, well, that's good, the patient's not tacky, but they're beta block, but the blood pressure's soft, you call echo, you get the TE, the TTE, and there's a big effusion that needs drain. So something to think about, both intra-op and in the recovery room.
Great. All right. Now, is the reason these patients need general anesthesia because of the TEE? I mean, is that really, because it seems like
That's the big reason. And it's also like it's tricky to place these clips. It's getting easier, obviously, with the improved Grasper and the G4 system that Mike had discussed. But it's a lot easier and safer, I think, if the patient's totally still to do this. Now, if they didn't need TEE, could you do it with a conscious sedation? Or maybe, but we're not there yet.
Okay. And maybe to come. All right. So, yeah. Mike, why don't you tell us a little bit about what kind of acute complications we can see hemodynamically with these placements?
Okay. So I think Joe started it off pretty well. So acutely, so whenever you're making the transseptal puncture, you know, there are a few things that can happen. If the procedure is a little anterior, they can actually potentially puncture into the aorta. So that can be an acute aortic dissection, damage of the aortic valve. And obviously that's a critical complication that needs cardiac surgery, you know, emergently. You can also go through and through when you do a transseptal puncture and damage the left atrial wall, the posterior wall, that would lead to, if it's not detected right away, that can lead to a slow tamponade, which, you know, Joe alluded to, you know, earlier. But if everything goes smoothly, though, there are two complications like associated with an optimal clipping that, you know, all anesthesiologists have to be aware of, and you have to plan appropriately. The first is microstenosis, which we shared that you do an initial screening to make sure the mitral area is greater than 4 centimeters squared for a patient to be included in the mitral clip. But one of the problems we run into is you may have a patient that has an optimal mitral area, but you put a first clip in and the MR correction is not appropriate. So you've gone from severe to moderate to severe, and then you put a second clip in and maybe a third, and then all of a sudden you have mitral stenosis. So you've converted a regurgitant lesion to a stenotic lesion. So it's critical that when they put in this, you know, the clip in before they do the final release, you measure left atrial pressure, you do your gradients, and you also can trace, it becomes a double orifice. So you can trace the two areas of the, you know, the mitral valve and sum it together to see what the effective orifice area is. So that's one thing. But another complication that we actually have done a lot of work in this space at Ohio State, and also Dr. Dahlia, he's over in Adam Dahlia at MGH. He was also one of my, you know, colleagues a few years back. And we made an observation that in patients who had, it was a secondary MR patient who had a really low ejection fraction. And as soon as the clip was placed and the MR correction was great, we were all happy. And a few minutes later, the patient was profoundly hypotensive. And that's the concept of afterload mismatch. And the whole physiology is when you have mitral regurgitation, the ventricle is unloaded. It's loaded from a volume standpoint. So you have a high LV volumes, but pressure-wise, the ventricle is unloaded. As soon as you implant the mitral clip and you really collect the correct, you know, the MR, you take away that pressure relief system into the left atrial circulation. So all of a sudden, a ventricle that really doesn't spend too much time in isovolumic contraction now has to generate all these pressures and squeeze into the, you know, the resistance or the impedance of the aorta. So that can really cause an acute heart failure. So there are a few risk factors for, you know, this afterload mismatch. One is high-risk patients. There was a recent publication where it was demonstrated that if your Euro score is greater than 12, there's a super high risk of developing afterload mismatch, which is essentially an acute heart failure after mitral clip implantation. So low ejection fraction people at EFs of 20% also at risk for, you know, afterload mismatch. And the reason we have to be aware is most of these Everest and Co-op trials did not include these super high risk patients. They were high risk on paper, but the ejection fractions were in a relatively moderate to severe range. Now that the mitral clip is approved, we are pushing the limits for compassionate, you know, treatment in patients with low ejection fraction. So the likelihood of afterload mismatch developing is really, really high. Echocardiography helps you, you know, identify afterload mismatch. So when you have hypotension after release, typically it's these two complications, stenosis or afterload mismatch. With stenosis, there is profound stasis in the left atrium. and you end up seeing what we call spontaneous echo contrast, which is like, quote unquote, smoke in the left atrium. But the left ventricle stays empty and is more clear regarding the contrast. Whereas with afterload mismatch, it's a left ventricular disease. So there is no limited forward flow from the left ventricle. So you end up with smoke in the left ventricle and in the left atrium. So that is one of the main complications of, you know, MitraClip therapy. So if you optimally correct the MR, that's what you're mostly going to see.
Okay, great. So that's, you know, I think it sounds to me like there's two categories of complications. There's things that go wrong with the procedure, like a puncture of the atrial wall, which is going to lead to a slow development of an effusion and maybe tamponade. That's obviously when something was done that shouldn't have been. But what you're, and then there's the second category, which you just talked about, which is even if everything goes as it should, you can still have either too much correction leading to stenosis, or you can have this now left ventricle, which used to have this pop-off valve of pressure going backwards, easy, you know, easy on the ventricle. Now it's got to really only push forward, and sometimes that ventricle can't do it and will fail acutely. And so those are things to look out for. Great. And you mentioned kind of what to look out for on the echo in terms of the contrast and the patients who are high risk for this being those patients with kind of those lower EFs going in. Anything else you want to add about complications, either one of you? Because obviously that's something people are going to want to look out for. But I don't know if you feel like you covered it all or if there's anything else you want to add.
I would say a big one. So tamponade is probably like, that's the biggest one that you just can't miss that. Like if they're hypotensive, you know, you have to make sure that tamponade is not going on. It's fixable and something, yeah, it's just shouldn't be missed. My other things, it's a big sheath. It's a 24 French sheath that goes into the femoral vein. So problems at the puncture site can pop up with bleeding, hematoma, and those kind of thing too. So that's something to keep in mind too. If I get called to the PACU and they're hypotensive, and even if it's for some other procedure that required femoral access, I'll be like, okay, like let's look at the groins, make sure there's not a problem there. A few other things, not as quite critical or acute. The MitraClip has been known to cause new onset AFib, something to think about. Endocarditis reports are out there that would not be in the acute setting. Very rare for that to occur, but it's there. A few other things we talked about a little bit. These clips can embolize, also rare, especially with the improvement of the clips and the more experience. The leaflets can actually tear or perforate from the clips, which could actually make the MR worse. Mitral stenosis, I think we talked about that enough. The one notable thing for mitral stenosis, though, say somebody has a grading of 5, which is borderline high or on the end, and those patients are followed at 3 months, 6 months, 12 months, that gradient stays at 5. So it's not where some MS where you're concerned, oh, is it going to progress? It usually doesn't. So if you have 5, when you're done with the case, you're going to keep 5. So.
Right. Is it fair to say you need to do these in a center that has a cardiac surgeon present? Because as you said, if something acutely, you get an aortic dissection or something, you can't be, you know, transporting the patient.
Yeah. At my center, the cardiac surgeon is actually scrubbed in and actually takes part of the clipping. That's not everywhere, but you definitely need backup readily available, not, oh, someone's at home or, basically you need a perfusionist and a cardiac surgeon who's ready to go pretty quickly should something go awry.
Gotcha.
I mean, yeah, Joe is absolutely right. And it's one of the things that even if, and on the contrary too, even if you have a cardiac surgeon who is, you know, which especially in Europe, they have skills with interventional procedures, right? You also should have a proceduralist with you. So there are a few publications where the transseptal puncture site actually may dissect out a little bit. So all of a sudden you have a critically wide open ASD with a shunt, and then the interventionalist went put a septal occluder in to obviously avoid a right to left shunt. So it's done where you need both teams. And another critical person is the echocardiographer and the cardiac anesthesiologist. And for centers that have, you know, let's say somebody like Joe, myself, who's a cardiac anesthesiologist, we bring the physiology and we also bring the echocardiography, you know, knowledge. But if it's a place where the cardiologist is doing the echo and the anesthesiologist is really doing the anesthetic, there should be close communication, because when a complication such as when they are releasing the clip and they are communicating with an interventionalist, you want to be listening. You want to be part of that communication. If there's a high risk for afterload mismatch or high risk for mitral stenosis, you have to have all your pharmacotherapeutics readily available, because you don't want to be out of the loop and then the clip is placed and now you have afterload mismatch, your blood pressure is 60, and you're calling pharmacy to get an ionodilator therapy. So we all have to really be part of the, you know, the discussion, especially during the critical phases of transseptal puncture, heparinization, clip delivery, and clipping. Yeah.
Great. And as you said, if you do develop heart failure because of the afterload mismatch, probably an ionodilator, so something like dobutamine, milrinone, something that's going to help your heart push and reduce the afterload it has to push against, is probably helpful. If you develop mitral stenosis, what is your kind of go-to treatment there in the acute setting?
Well, I hope if that does occur, it's picked up before it's the clip is released, because Mike had said earlier, it's as soon as that clip is deployed, it is stuck there. It's not coming off unless basically the valve comes out. So if you really end up with true mitral stenosis, and it's severe enough, I don't know if you have a better answer, Mike, but you're in a tough spot, because I don't think you could really intervene on that with a balloon or anything. Although, if you ask enough cardiologists, I'm sure you get someone to try. I don't have a good answer for that.
Yeah. I mean, Joe is correct. So you do your due diligence before you release the clip. So once you clip them, they use, especially with the newer G4 system, they measure left atrial pressure to see MR is corrected. They use echo. We do gradients. We do planimetry. You look at color flow Doppler. You look at your pulmonary veins. So you do enough due diligence that even if there's a gradient of maybe 5 to 10, it may be a gradient that, quote unquote, is stenotic, but there's still adequate forward flow to carry the patient, you know, for the rest of their lives. So a gradient of 5 in, you know, that's one of the reasons that the mitral clip is not, you know, approved for like a younger patient who has, you know, a prolapse or flail and surgery still the primary therapy, because a gradient of 5 is not too bad when you're not, you know, working out. But when you become tachycardic and the left atrial pressure increases, that will lead to heart failure, you know, symptoms from exertion. So in the mitral clip population, most of these patients, especially those with profound heart failure, it's you're trying to basically reduce that volume, sort of decrease the progression of the LV dysfunction from the volume overload, and you trade off maybe a slight gradient. But from the Everest trial, no, sorry, from the co-op trial and a few other reports, even patients with gradients still had reduction in heart failure hospitalizations. And they also had improved survival in comparison with those that were just on medical therapy. So unless you really, really get too crazy, the likelihood of critical mitral stenosis is low, because all the the multidisciplinary team, everybody checks each other to make sure we're doing the best thing.
Great. Now, this is all still pretty new, so there may not be anything newer on the horizon, but let me just ask, when we think about what's coming down the pike, is there anything exciting, you know, that is going to be an improvement on this or anything that you guys are aware of?
I saw something in Europe, but yeah, you go, Mike. Yeah.
Okay. So obviously the microclip is going to be advanced again. So that's, you know, that's like the TAVR system. But there's a Pascal system, which is an Edwards version. It's similar to the clip, but it's from its delivery. It's actually approved for, you know, commercial use in Europe. It's under investigation. If it wasn't for COVID, probably those trials would have been completed. And from what I've read, I haven't had the experience of seeing it implanted. It actually places less tension on the leaflets and may be a little better hemodynamically than the mitral clip. So it's yet to be, you know, determined. But the Pascal is it's also a clip, similar in functionality, but obviously for proprietary reasons, there are slight design differences.
Gotcha. Yeah.
And it's sort of a different podcast topic, but I know that there are companies out there trying to come up with basically a TAVR valve for the mitral position. I mean, they exist. It's been done, but the success rate is so-so, and the complication rate's fairly high. So there is a select set of patients that may be candidates for a valve, like for basically a TAVR in the mitral position. So right now that has a lot of kind of trouble. I don't know if in the future, if we're going to keep, you know, in 10 years, are we going to be doing clips or are we going to be doing valves? Who knows, but it's still a growing field and there's still, you know, where there's still a good number of patients that are better suited to open surgery than the clip. So that may change too. I don't know. It's and if you think about it, the Alfieri stitch came out in 1991 or so, and then the clip started in 2003 or so. So things, I mean, that's really not that long ago, and things have really changed. So I think they're going to just change more and more. It's a pretty exciting. I love my job. It's pretty exciting field. I'm always seems like things are getting better. So.
Yeah, well, it'll be exciting to see, and we'll have you guys back on to talk more about them when the new things come out. Great. Well, let's turn to the portion of our show where we make random recommendations. Joe, maybe we'll start with you. Do you have something you'd recommend the audience check out?
Sure. So I wanted to give a shout out to anyone who works in critical care and does palliative care. I just got done with this book. It's going to sound a little morbid, but it's worth the read. It's called a Beginner's Guide to the End: Practical Advice for Living Life and Facing Death. It's by a Dr. B.J. Miller. He's a palliative care physician, and it just sort of puts it's not meant for physicians, but it's meant for anybody. And it just kind of puts dealing with life and dealing with death that comes with life into the big picture perspective. And I thought it was a very a helpful book. I don't do a whole lot of critical care, but they're like per se in the ICU setting. But I think there are certainly times in my day when I'm taking care of a patient where they may be going under some kind of surgery or procedure, and I wonder, hey, is this really appropriate or that sort of thing, and it sort of kind of helps me to call the surgeon or the proceduralist and say, hey, are we doing the right thing? Should we consider palliative care? So, shout out to Dr. Miller's book. And to really anyone who does ICU and involved in that palliative care medicine.
Well, thanks, Joe. Actually, BJ Miller was one of the two folks who did most of our palliative care curriculum at UCSF when I was a medical student there.
Oh,
and cool. He was an incredible guy with an incredible life story and was just taught incredibly well and spoke powerfully about palliative care. And so I couldn't agree more. I haven't read the book, but I'm glad you mentioned it. And I'm sure, knowing him, that it's really well done. So thanks for recommending that. Mike, how about you?
All right. I would recommend this book by Ray Dalio. This is actually different. Over the years, my fellows encouraged me to kind of read a little bit more outside of medicine. So I started doing more in the, you know, just on the business, just picking up great books. But Principles by Ray Dalio, he's a hedge. I think he's a manager of the largest hedge fund, you know, in the world. And he just goes into, he shares his approach to life management, certain criteria that he uses to make decisions. And I found it to be quite fascinating. It's a really, really, it's easy to read and it can improve your skills as a leader, you know, father, just name it. It's so I think for, you know, for your listeners, I think that would be a great book to read.
That's awesome. Thanks, Mike. And this is a big improvement. I think your first random recommendation was like to people to read Miller's Anesthesiology or something like that.
That's so right. Yeah.
This is a step up. All right.
Yes.
Excellent. Well, we have a listener recommendation. This was tweeted at us from John Bailey, and he recommends a Twitter account, which is at Kurzgesagt. And I'll spell that. It's at KURZ underscore GE, S like Sam, A like Apple, G, T like Tom. And it's really interesting, actually, this Twitter account, they make science videos on really interesting stuff. Like one recently was about the fact that actually it's not that wild to think about the moon crashing into the earth and what would the kind of geometry of that look like and how would it happen and what would happen if it did. And then they also have things on optical illusions and questions kind of exploring whether we're alone in the universe and how to think about that and what the mathematical chances are and things like that. So really interesting. I will be spending a little more time on that and I recommend people check it out too. So thanks to John for shouting that out. And then my recommendation, and you know, I can't remember if I already said this on a prior episode. So if I did, I apologize for the redundancy, but there's a show on HBO Plus called Dope Sick, and it is incredible. It is about the opioid epidemic and the release of OxyContin and Purdue Pharma and the whole kind of initial thing that led to all the addiction and the lawsuits, and it takes you through it. It's incredibly well acted. Amazing actors, amazing actresses. It just really, really well done. The story is incredibly well told. It's not a happy show. It's quite sobering, but I think since it's real and it tells a true story about kind of that really tells you a lot about what's happening in our society, it's worth checking out. Not just because it's well done, but because it's quite still applicable. All right. Well, guys, thank you so much for coming back on the show. This was great. I really appreciate it. And we'll look forward to next time.
Thanks so much, Jed.
Well, thank you so much, Jed. Thanks for having us.
All right. Hopefully you got as much out of that as I did. That was really fantastic. Let us know what you thought. Go to the website, acrac.com, where you can leave a comment. Others can learn from what you have to say. If you are a fan of the show, you can follow us. We're on Twitter. We are on Facebook. We are on Reddit. And we are on Instagram. I'm at Jay Wolpaw on Twitter, and we're at ACRAC Podcast, and you can find us on all those other platforms as well. If you are a fan of the show, please consider going to Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts and leaving a comment and a rating. It really helps others find the show. If you'd like to support the making of the show, please consider going to patreon.com/ACRAC. That's patreon.com/ACRAC, where you can become a patron of the show. Even if it's just a dollar or two that you pledge, it makes a big difference, and we really appreciate it. You can also make donations anytime by going to paypal.me/ACRAC or looking up Jay Wolpaw on Venmo. Thank you so much to those who have already made donations and become patrons. We really appreciate it. Thanks, as always, to our fantastic ACRAC crew. Dr. Brian Park is our tech lead. Ryan Okonski is our social media manager. And Drs. Kimia Kashkuli and April Liu are our production assistants. Thank you so much for all that you do. Our original ACRAC music is by Dr. Dennis Kuo. You can check out his website at studymusicproject.com. All right. That is it for today. For the ACRAC podcast, I'm Jed Wolpaw. Thanks for listening. Remember, what you're doing out there every day is really important and valued.